Numbers chapter 25, if you remember, the last time we were in Numbers together, we were finishing the story of Balaam, the false prophet. Came all the way from Mesopotamia to curse. That was supposed to be his job, curse Israel three times, and he blessed them instead, and cursed the fellow that asked him to curse Israel. We heard of Balaam, so we thought was in those words in Numbers chapter 24 and verse 25. And Balaam rose up and returned to his place. We thought that was the last that we were going to hear about Balaam. And he rose up and returned to his place. But just before his last parable, which Balak didn't ask for, by the way, he just kind of volunteered it, Balaam talked about going to my people. But first he would give a word about what this people, by whom he meant Israel, would go to thy people, by whom he meant Balak's Moabites, in the latter days. Look at chapter 24 and verse 14 just a moment, just to refresh our minds a little bit. Now behold, he said, I go unto my people. Of course, he was from Mesopotamia. And come therefore, and I will advertise thee what this people. He was there to curse Israel, but he's got to bless them three times, and now he's going to tell what they're going to do to the Moabites in the latter days, what they shall do to thy people in the latter days, the Moabites. And so, as far as we know, at the end of the last chapter, Balaam was on his way back to Mesopotamia, from which he had traveled with the contingency from Balak the Moabite in order to curse the nation of Israel that was dwelling near his land. And Moses kind of referred back to this in Deuteronomy chapter 23. Deuteronomy 23, Moses preached about three sermons. Actually, in the whole book of Deuteronomy, in Deuteronomy 23, this was one of them. And he was referring back in Israel's history, and he said in chapter 23 and verse 4, because they met you not with bread and with water in the way, he's talking about the Moabites, when you came forth out of Egypt, and because they hired against thee Balaam, the son of Beor, of Pethor of Mesopotamia, to curse thee. Now, all of us, all along, have been a bit puzzled about this Balaam character, haven't you? Balaam, he's a puzzling character, because in Numbers chapter 23 and 24, he gives some astounding prophecies that include a prophecy of the coming Messiah. He talks about the star that will rise up out of Jacob. Look at 24:17, for example. I shall see him, but not now. I shall behold him, but not nigh. There shall come a star out of Jacob, and a scepter, you know, the thing that a king holds, a rod, shall rise out of Israel, and shall smite the corners of Moab, and destroy all the children of Sheth. That's when he cursed Moab instead of Israel. And so we saw that in Numbers 24:17. We saw that it was a prophecy that was fulfilled in Matthew chapter 2 when the wise men came to pay to the Lord Jesus because they came seeing his star in the east. Matthew chapter 2 and verse 2, it wasn't just a star, it was his star they saw. When they saw his star, they began making that trek to the promised land. They worshiped him as the king of the Jews. And it boggles our minds, because how can we be sure that this person who made this prophecy about the Messiah, who made these declarations about the blessedness of Israel, how could we be sure that he is not a believer in the one true God? Because it certainly sounds like he is. Well, we actually learned about that in this message, that he wasn't a believer at all. Even though Balaam's name is not mentioned in the entire 25th chapter, we're going to see why he wasn't among God's people. It is, however, mentioned in Numbers chapter 31, referring back to this incident, and we'll take a look at that in just a minute. So we're going to find that after Balaam had finally convinced Balak that sorcery and supernatural curses were not going to work on Israel, he left Balak with a bit of counsel. Went from a curse to counsel. And that counsel would accomplish what he desired for Israel after all. That is what Balak desired, that counsel. Balaam had found that he could not manipulate Jehovah in order to get him to curse his people, but he knew God's people well enough to believe that they could be manipulated to bring God's curse upon themselves. And that's exactly what he did. In other words, what he could not accomplish with an ungodly curse, he would accomplish with ungodly counsel. You know, the psalmist had something to say about that in Psalms chapter 1 and verse 1. He said, what did he say? Blessed is the man that walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly. So many times we get caught in the counsel. And we curse ourselves instead of bringing God's curse upon us. In this case, neither Balaam, who gave the counsel, or Balak, who received it, could be called blessed. They weren't happy at all. Blessed simply means happy. They weren't happy. In chapter 24, verses 10 and 11, for example, look, Balak's anger was kindled against Balaam, and he smote his hands together. I think he wanted to hit Balaam myself, but he didn't want to hear prophet, so he clapped his hands at him. He wasn't applauding him, by the way. And he smote his hands together, and Balak said unto Balaam, I called thee to curse mine enemies, and behold, thou hast altogether blessed them these three times. Therefore now flee thou to thy place. I thought to promote thee unto great honor, but lo, notice it, the Lord, Jehovah, the Lord hath kept thee back from honor. It's all the Lord's fault. I wanted to promote you. I wanted to give you all these things, and he's kept you from getting them. It's the Lord's fault. So Balaam had failed to conquer Israel through supernatural curses. And he had failed to undermine the advance of Israel through sorcery. And Balak's plan to get the famous seer Balaam to come and to place a curse on Israel had utterly failed. Israel was unfazed, and in fact, Balaam had announced that Israel was blessed of God. Just the opposite. But before he left, he suggested one idea to Balak. This is his counsel. In chapter 31 and verse 16, we're going to see that. See what that was. Balak, he said, let me suggest that you send some ritual prostitutes. That was part of the Baal worship at that time. Send some of those ritual prostitutes into Israel. Approach the men of Israel. Invite them to come and to feast with you at your feast for the Baal of Peor. And by that, you can bring God's curse upon Israel. That proves to me he was not a prophet of God, right? Right away. He was not a prophet of God. No matter what God used him to do back here, he was not God's prophet. So this chapter, 25, will reveal that Balaam's ungodly counsel, it worked like a charm. Worked like a charm. What couldn't be accomplished with those curses was going to work like a charm from this counsel. So the prophet, who was a mouthpiece for Jehovah, was like so many. What came out of his mouth and what was in his heart were far removed from each other. A lot of prophets are that way. What comes out of their mouth is far removed from what's in their heart. It's always been so. Look at Isaiah. Keep your finger here. Look at Isaiah chapter 29, verse 13, just a moment. Isaiah 29, 13. Isaiah chapter 29, verse 13. Isaiah says this, he says, wherefore the Lord said, forasmuch as this people draw near me with their mouth, and he's talking about God's people here, this people draw near me with their mouth, and with their lips they do honor me, but they have removed their heart far from me. And their fear toward me is taught by the precept of men. They're just listening to men more than they're listening to me. They talk about me with their mouth, but their heart is far away. You know, there's some folks around like that today that call themselves God's people, and they're always talking about the Lord, and they're always talking about this, but in their heart, nothing's really happened. They just learned the vocabulary of Christianity, but nothing's really happened in their heart. And so, he was like that. Matthew chapter 15, verses 7 and 8, why the Lord goes back and quotes those words, of course. Balaam's wickedness is seen by this suggestion that he makes to the Moabites and the Midianites for the undoing of Israel. We know right away he's wicked. There are several lessons that we can take from this tragic sequel, however. Some lessons that we can learn. Another sordid event in Israel's journey to the promised land. That's what this was, but we can learn some lessons from it. They might be negative lessons, like those lessons Pastor was teaching us on Wednesday night from Lot. You know, they were negative lessons, but they were lessons nevertheless. And so as we go into this portion of Scripture, all that was the introduction. You're saying, oh my, you know, but we won't take so long going through the message. Israel's sin exposed. That's Roman numeral 1. Israel's sin is exposed. Now I want you to turn, we're going to read those five verses in a bit, but I want you to turn to Revelation chapter 2 and verse 14. Keep your finger here. Revelation chapter 2 and verse 14. You say, man, what's that got to do with this verse? Well, I'll try to show you. Revelation chapter 2 and verse 15. Sorry, verse 14. 2:14. But I have a few things against thee. This is the church at Pergamos he's talking about. Because thou hast there them that hold the doctrine of who? Balaam. Yeah, the doctrine of Balaam there in that church in Asia called Pergamos. And so he said, there are some of you that hold the doctrine of Balaam. Notice what he taught. He taught Balak to cast a stumbling block before the children of Israel to eat things sacrificed unto idols. That was one thing. But not only that, to commit fornication. Fornication. Now, in the Greek language, that word fornication is the same Greek word that's translated into English as pornography. Pornography. It's interesting, isn't it? So he used fornication. He used fornication. So this was illicit sexual sin that he was talking about here. That's what they used to make them stumble back there. Well, I said all that. Now let's go back to chapter 25. Chapter 25. Because in the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of this Hebrew Old Testament, that same word that's translated fornication over there in Revelation is used here. But it's called another word, but we can see the similarity. Look at it. In verse 1. First of all, we're going to see their immorality in verse 1. And Israel abode in Shittim, and the people began to commit whoredom. Same word in the Greek as was translated fornication over there in Revelation. They commit whoredom with the daughters of Moab. So the Moabites and the Midianites had made an alliance with each other at this time, you remember. Numbers chapter 22 and verse 4. Look at it just a moment. Numbers chapter 22. In verse 4, Moab said unto the elders of Midian. So Moab and Midianites were together. Moab said unto the elders of Midian, now shall this company lick up all that are round about us, talking about Israel, of course, as the ox licketh up their grass of the field, and Balak the son of Zippor was king of the Moabites at that time. So there was an alliance between the Moabites and the Midianites. And so the Israelites were encamped in a place called Shittim, we're told here, named after the kind of wood that was found there. All the way through the Old Testament, you'll find that there's shittim wood here and there. And it was located on the east side of Jordan, of course, getting ready to enter the promised land. That's the land of the east side of Jordan is where Jordan is right now. And what Balaam couldn't accomplish with his appeal to Satan, as we said before, he was able to accomplish with his appeal to the flesh of the Israelites. The flesh of the Israelites. So in effect, he counseled Balak, saying this, Israel has been in the wilderness a long time, almost 40 years. They've been eating the same thing over and over and over again, manna. Manna. 1,001 ways to cook manna. They had a cookbook like that. Manna. They didn't really. So they've been eating the same thing all over and over again. So you tell them about all the wonderful Midianite, Moabite food that's going to be at this feast. Going to have a feast. And you let them see some of those beautiful women also. And you invite them to come to that great feast. It was another diabolical plan, of course, but unlike all of Balaam's other efforts, it worked, as we said, like a charm. Baal was the chief of the Canaanite gods, and he was especially responsible for rain and fertility. Not just fertility in the ground, but fertility in birth and all of those things. Until they went off to Babylon, the Israelites were an agricultural people, and sad to say, whenever there was a drought, they often turned to Baal for help instead of to the Lord. Now, the Canaanite fertility rites involved both male and female temple prostitutes and encouraged all kinds of sexual immorality called whoredom in this verse, called fornication over there in Revelation chapter 2. So we see their immorality here. But there is something even more diabolical about it, if there can be anything more. Secondly, we see their idolatry. Their idolatry in verses 2 through 5. And we split that up just a little bit. Notice number 1, the record of their idolatry in verse 2 and the first part of verse 3. Look at Numbers chapter 25, verse 2, and they called the people unto the sacrifices of their gods, and the people did eat and bowed down to their gods. And Israel joined himself, that's talking about the whole nation here, and Israel joined himself unto Baal Peor. So, we see this idolatry, the record of this idolatry, the immorality was certainly bad enough, as we said. It was physical fornication. It was physical adultery. But they didn't stop there. They also committed spiritual fornication. They committed spiritual adultery. And that's known as idolatry. It's called idolatry. Such terrible memories they had. They had awful memories. Because only 40 years before, you know what they had done when they came out of Egypt? Moses went up into the mountain, and remember Aaron gathered all this gold, and his story was that he just threw it in a fire and out popped this calf. You know, that was his story. Moses knew a little better than that, of course. But anyhow, they just had that happen about 40 years ago. Thousands of people died as a result of that, and here they were again. And that had to do with the gods of Egypt. Of course, 40 years ago, that was mostly the prior generation. Most of that generation had already suffered because of all of that. They'd already died off, and also because of their disobedience and not going into the promised land to begin with. But this is the new generation, and they still have bad memories. That had to do with the gods of Egypt. But now, only 38 years later, as they prepare to enter Canaan, they fall into the same sin as those nations they were to drive out before them, in direct rebellion against God's command to them. That's exactly what he told them not to do. And they're not even in the land yet, and they've already fallen into that sin. And instead of being a witness to those nations and worshiping the only true and living God, they were leaving off worship of Jehovah and worshiping their dead idols. In this case, it was called Baal Peor. You know, each place had their own Baal. Now, they deserve our condemnation, but I wonder how many of our friends and our colleagues and our schoolmates and our family members can tell that we are worshiping the Lord and not materialism and pleasures of this world. Same thing that they worship many times. Paul gave a very telling analysis of the sin of materialism. He really did. Only he called it covetousness. Keep your finger here and look at Colossians chapter 3 just a moment. Colossians chapter 3 and verse 5. Colossians chapter 3 and verse 5. Very interesting verse. He says, mortify, therefore, put to death, therefore, the members which are your members. He's talking about your bodily members, which are upon the earth. Fornication, uncleanness, inordinate affection, evil concupiscence, and covetousness. Then he tells what covetousness really is. Covetousness, which is what? Idolatry. Huh? Idolatry. Well, that's the record of their idolatry. Look at the result of it there in verse, last part of verse 3 to verse 5. Last part of verse 3 says, and the anger of the Lord, Jehovah, was kindled against Israel. Against Israel. And the Lord said unto Moses, take all the heads of the people and hang them up before the Lord against the sun, that the fierce anger of the Lord may be turned away from Israel. So the result was the Lord's anger was kindled. That simply means it was made hot. You know, when we gather firewood to make a fire, it's called kindling, the first little bits. Made hot against his people as well as it should have been. Israel was defecting from their loyalty and their allegiance to the Lord who had saved them out of bondage in Egypt. He'd saved them out. He'd brought them through the wilderness for 38 years. They were going after other gods because of their physical and sexual appetites. And the Lord sent a plague that began to kill the people, and so Moses moved into action. That's happened several times in their history. And following God's orders, he commanded the judges in each tribe to kill the people who had led Israel into this terrible sin and to expose their bodies as a warning to the rest of the people. Hang them up, especially their heads. But as we're about to see, one special act of judgment helped to bring the plague to an end and save the rest of the nation, because I believe God would have consumed them. He would have consumed them. But it was stayed. We're going to see that next. Roman numeral 2, Israel's sin exemplified. Israel's sin exemplified. Notice, first of all, the perpetrator. The perpetrator. Perpetrator of that sin. Verse 6. Chapter 25, verse 6. And behold, one of the children of Israel came and brought unto his brethren, we're going to find out later who this is and who the woman is too, but right now it's just one of the children of Israel, and brought unto his brethren a Midianitish woman. Oh, there she is. Brought her there in the sight of Moses and in the sight of all the congregation of the children of Israel who were weeping before the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. So there were some there who were weeping over all of this. They were not for it at all. But in the middle of the children of Israel who were faithful, in the middle of the loyal children of Israel who are gathered around the tent of meeting where the Ark of the Covenant was kept, and weeping because of Israel's sin, and they're begging for God's forgiveness. While this is going on, you can picture it, can't you? Strolling down the middle of the street in the camp of Israel comes this man of Israel, and he's got a Midianite woman on his arm. You know what I mean by that? He's not carrying her, of course. You know, he's walking with her down the street. And he walks right down in broad daylight, front of the tent of meeting, and he walks her right over to the family tent, and he takes her inside. It's a public defiance of God. It's sin in the face of repentance. And while Moses and the leaders of Israel, who had not been involved in this sin, are tearing their clothes and pulling on their hair and pleading with God and begging God to spare his people and to forgive them for their sins, this man is publicly saying, I'm going to do this anyway. I don't care what Moses says. I don't care about the leaders of Israel. I don't care what the priest said. I don't care what Jehovah says. I did it my way. Have you ever heard that song? I did it my way. Frank Sinatra sang that, I think. Well, there's Proverbs 16:25 again. Proverbs 16:25. I keep wanting to memorize that, but I keep forgetting it. Proverbs 16:25. Proverbs 16:25. There is a way that seemeth right unto a man. Seems right unto a man, but the end thereof are the ways of death. Ways of death. And then we see the punishment, verses 7 through 9. Look at verse 7. And when Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, so he's the grandson of Aaron, he's the priest, he saw it, he rose up from among the congregation, took a pretty drastic step. He took a javelin in his hand, a spear. And he went over after the man of Israel into the tent and thrust both of them through, the man of Israel and the woman through her belly. So the plague was stayed from the children of Israel. Now, it sounds pretty harsh, but that was a pretty harsh sin, you see. Pretty harsh sin. Aaron's grandson Phinehas left the prayer meeting. He went after the couple, killing both of them in the tent, apparently with one thrust of the spear. Now remember, they were not only involved in sexual immorality, they were involved in spiritual immorality. It wasn't just physical fornication that was going on here, which would have been bad enough. It was idolatry. It was apostasy. It was turning their back on the God of Israel, the God who saves, the holy and righteous God, that was turning their back on him. And Phinehas killed them both right on the spot. You know what the wages of sin is? It's death. Right. It's death. And notice their prominence. Their prominence here in verses, going down to verse 14 and 15. We'll come back to these others. Verse 14 and 15 gives us their prominence. The ones that were slain. Now the name of the Israelite that was slain, even that was slain with the Midianitish woman, was Zimri, the son of Salu. Notice who his dad was. A prince of a chief house among the Simeonites. So he's a big man among the tribe of Simeon. And the name of the Midianitish woman that was slain was Cozbi, the daughter of Zur. Notice who he was. He was head over a people and of a chief house in Midian. So these weren't a couple of down and out kids, you know. These were kids that were pretty high on the social scale, but they were still sinning. Zimri against the Lord, of course. And I suppose Zur didn't much care what his daughter did, being a Midianite. So we see the prominence. In these verses, we learn that this Jewish man and the Midianite woman were both from prominent families among their people. Perhaps like many today, they thought their social status gave them the privilege of sinning. And a lot of folks believe that. At any rate, the names of these two brazen sinners were recorded for all time, along with their family names. What a shame they brought on their families. No one is so prominent that they will not be held accountable for their sin. No one. No one. You can look at Revelation 20 and verse 12 concerning that. Roman numeral 3, verses 10 through 13. Phinehas's zeal is extolled. Phinehas's zeal is extolled. Verse 10 to 13. Notice in verses 10 and 11 the reason for his zeal. A is the reason for his zeal. Back in Numbers 25 again, verse 10 and 11. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, hath turned my wrath away from the children of Israel, while he was zealous for my sake among them, that I consume not the children of Israel in my jealousy. So, the reason for his zeal, it's pretty important here. Reason for his zeal. He was not zealous for his own profit. He wasn't trying to climb the priestly ladder, you know. Wasn't zealous for his own profit. He wasn't zealous for his own reward, but he was zealous for Jehovah's sake, says here. For Jehovah's sake. And because of that, his action stopped the plague. But it wasn't stopped before there were 24,000 people that died. In verse 9, look at it. And those that died in the plague were 24,000. Been a lot more than been for Phinehas. But even then, there were 24,000 people. And because of this action, it stopped the plague, but not before those 24,000 were killed. What a price sin exacts. Once again, God graciously accepts Phinehas' action as a reason to save his people from extinction. He didn't consume them. That's what the word consume means. He didn't do away with them altogether. Well, look at the result of his zeal in verses 12 and 13. Wherefore say, behold, I give unto him my covenant of peace. He shall have it, and his seed after him, even the covenant of an everlasting priesthood, because he was zealous for his God, and he made an atonement for the children of Israel. He made an atonement for the children of Israel. Now, because of his zeal for the honor of the Lord, and because Phinehas was given he was given a special reward of a lasting priesthood for himself and his descendants. He knew nothing about this reward before he acted, so his motive wasn't selfish. He didn't know he was going to get this reward when he did it. He was motivated by his zeal for the honor of God and the authority of God's law. And like the father of faith, Abraham, Phinehas proved his faith by his what? Proved his faith by his works, by his action. And it was accounted to him, the Bible says, for righteousness. It was accounted unto him for righteousness. And so we can see that in Galatians chapter 3 and verse 6, Psalms 106, verse 28. Then we see Midian's punishment exacted. The last few verses here. Midian's punishment exacted. Those verses 16 to 18. And thus, break that down just a little bit. Notice the punishment extended. What was the punishment extended here? Verses 16 and 17 says this, and the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, vex the Midianites and smite them. Vex the Midianites and smite them. So God declared that the Midianites were to be considered the enemies of Israel, had to be killed. Moses will carry out this command over in chapter 31. We'll get there one of these days. Chapter 31. So we'll look at the details at that time. We just know that the Midianites are going to get their comeuppance eventually. We'll see that Balaam will meet his final end at the same time. And also the father of Cozbi, the Midianite woman as well. He's going to be involved over in Numbers chapter 31 and verse 8. Let's get a sneak preview. Chapter 31 and verse 8. And they slew, this is the Israelites, and they slew the kings of Midian, beside the rest of them that were slain, namely Evi and Rechem and Zur. Remember, Zur was the father of Cozbi. And Hur and Reba, and five kings of Midian. Balaam also, the son of Beor, they slew with a sword. So he comes to that end. And we'll see that when we get there in more detail. Then the punishment is explained. Punishment is explained in verse 18. God didn't just mete out that punishment and then not explain why it was necessary. For they vex you with their wiles. That's why. talking about Israel. They, the Midianites, they vex you, Israel, with their wiles, wherewith they have beguiled you in the matter of Peor, and in the matter of Cozbi, the daughter of a prince of Midian, their sister, which was slain in the day of the plague for Peor's sake. Now, punishment explained. Their religious practices were abominably filthy. And the only way God could remove this cancer was to wipe out the people that were involved. Almost the entire population, although he didn't do away with all the Midianites, even in chapter 31, because later on we're going to find out that Gideon had to face the Midianites again. So it wasn't the whole nation of Midian, but it was certain tribes. He wiped them out. Israel had an important task to perform for the Lord, and the presence of those wicked nations was only a temptation to the Jews to sin. It would be a poor doctor indeed who refused to remove an operable cancerous tumor in order to keep from hurting the patient's feelings. You wouldn't want somebody to do that to you, right? I mean, if you had a cancerous tumor and it could be operated upon, I wouldn't be much of a doctor who said, well, you're okay, go on home. You know, I don't want to hurt your feelings. And if I tell you about it, why, you're going to be sad. And all. So I'll just let you go home with the cancer. Well, we'd say, we'd try to find a lawyer, probably, and try to get something out of him. It'd be a poor doctor if he did that. Many times God has to use the two-edged sword of his word, to cut away the sinful fleshly activities of his people. Why? In order to keep them from dishonoring him. Well, there's a couple of lessons we can learn from all of this. Couple of lessons. First of all, we are most vulnerable to Satan's attacks after a victory. That's a very important lesson to learn. We are most vulnerable to Satan's attacks after a victory. Because we're on the mountain, you know, we've been victorious, God's given us victory over something, and so we feel like we could, the saying is, we could charge hell with a water pistol, you know. We can take on anything. I look at this victory God has given to us. And then all of a sudden, pow, you know, something comes along. Well, we need to learn that lesson. We're most vulnerable to Satan's attacks after a victory. There is no deliverance so bright, and there is no victory that God wins on our behalf so glorious that it cannot be followed by the darkest of our sins. Our sins. After the victory of the Red Sea, you remember, came the defeat of the golden calf. I mean, they had just crossed that Red Sea. Can you imagine that? The Red Sea had just parted. All of the Israelites had gotten over, every one of them. It had come back and destroyed Pharaoh's army. They'd been given some water, and they'd been given some food, and they'd been taken to Mount Sinai, and they were getting the law, and Moses was up the mountain getting the law, and they turned around and made a golden calf. Who'd have thought they'd been that vulnerable to sin at that time? So, after the victory of the Red Sea, there was the golden calf. After David was given a covenant promised by God in 2 Samuel chapter 7, that's where he was given the Davidic covenant, covenant that he'd have an everlasting kingship. Five chapters later, he's out on the rooftop and he sees Bathsheba and he commits a terrible sin. Two of them, adultery and murder, had her husband murdered. I mean, right after he'd gotten that Davidic covenant from the Lord. So, we are most vulnerable to Satan's attacks after a victory. It's a good lesson to learn. Another good lesson to learn is Satan is very persistent. Satan is very persistent. Do you look through all of these things? If he can't make us stumble one way, he'll use another tactic. He knows where we are vulnerable. He knows where we are vulnerable. He's not omnipotent, but he knows where we are vulnerable. Sorcery couldn't get Israel. Sorcery couldn't get them. Three times he told them the curse. Remember, they made all the altars. They sacrificed all the oxen and all the rams. And three times he was supposed to curse them. Three times he blessed them. And on the last time, he cursed the one who wanted to curse them. Big victories. But they withstood all of those things. Then all of a sudden, one little word of counsel from Balaam. And they cursed themselves, brought curse upon themselves. Brought a curse. Sorcery couldn't get Israel, but sex and idolatry did. And if our guard is up in one place and we fend off the temptations of Satan there, don't think that he can't come back with another strategy. He can. He will, and he did here with the Israelites. Satan will use any temptation at his disposal to ruin us. And if we manfully or womanfully, it could be either one. If we resist temptation in one area, we must not expect not to face temptation in another. Temptation's there. Many a believer has resisted faithfully in one area and yet fallen in another. Remember that famous verse we've looked at many times, 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 8. Let's look at it one more time. 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 8. 1 Peter 5:8. Be sober. That doesn't mean don't get drunk. It means be serious, in this context. There are other places where it means that. Be sober and be vigilant. Be sober and be vigilant. Because, this is why. Because your adversary, the devil, as a roaring lion, he's walking about. He's not standing still. He's not sitting off somewhere having coffee, he's walking about seeking whom he may devour. He's always doing that. He keeps on walking about. And if he can't devour us one way, he seeks some other ways for doing it. So many a believer has resisted faithfully in one area and yet fallen in another. Be warned. That's a good lesson to learn from the Israelites here. Let us be sober and be vigilant. But our greatest defense is to submit to God and draw nigh to Him. Submit to God and draw nigh to Him. We have that responsibility. We have it. Look at James and we'll close. James chapter 4, verses 7 and 8. James chapter 4, verses 7 and 8. James chapter 4, verse 7. Submit yourselves, therefore, to God. Then what does he say? Resist the devil. But you submit first. Submit yourself, therefore, to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. But you're not going to be able to resist him until you've submitted to God. Just doesn't work. Can't do it in your own strength. Verse 8, draw nigh to God, and he will draw nigh to you. Cleanse your hands, ye sinners, and purify your hearts, ye double-minded. And so, our greatest defense is to submit to God and draw nigh to him. I hope we can learn those two lessons. Hope we can put them into practice in our lives, as we remember this story that happened some 2,500 years ago, but it still has some lessons to teach us today. Let's bow our heads.